Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. What do you get when a librarian, 7-Eleven connoisseur, and respected Twitter humorist writes a novel about a gay female taxidermist in Central Florida? Well, you get a New York Times bestseller. Kristen Arnett's first novel, Mostly Dead Things, is about love, loss, and the art of preserving dead animals. The New York Times calls the book, quote, a cabinet of wonders, end quote, and says Arnett is an important new voice in the tradition of Florida writers like Zora Neale Hurston and Karen Russell. We caught up with Arnett when she was in town this month, and I began by asking her to lay out the plot of Mostly Dead Things.
The elevator pitch, yes. Okay, so lesbian taxidermist in Central Florida takes over her family's taxidermy business after her father commits suicide in the taxidermy shop.
Okay, so I have to tell you, this is how brilliant that was, because the producer wrote a synopsis. I've read the book, but yeah. Wrote a synopsis. I have to read it to you. Lesbian taxidermist in Florida taking over shop for her father who shot himself on the workday.
Yeah!
So clearly the subject matter of the book comes across.
Yeah.
but that is a very specific premise.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. So how did you get to that specific idea?
Yeah. I knew a couple things about writing this book. I knew that I wanted it to be a book about grief and loss. I knew I wanted it to be about Florida, specifically the Central Florida that I've experienced. I'm third generation Central Floridian. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to be able to look at those kind of themes with something that would enable me to take hold of the physical and the tactile. So that's very much taxidermy, right? So like taxidermy carries a lot of the weight of this book. It allows like people to process memory and nostalgia, because this is a book a lot about memory and nostalgia in this way that taxidermy helps with, right? Because taxidermy is memory. Taxidermy is these very specifically posed memories. So I knew I wanted something that would I'd be able to be like very physical and tactile with and be able to get into like kind of the gross nitty-gritty, also like dealing with how people perceive Florida, which is sometimes in this way that they think of as tacky.
Mm-hmm.
And taxidermy just carried a lot of that weight for me. I did a ton of research. I'm also a librarian, so yeah.
There you go. And I was going to ask you about that because there was so much acute and specific detail about taxidermy that, by the way, wasn't boring, and who knew that was possible, that I found myself thinking, okay, so is she descended from taxidermists? I mean, how does she? Did you really just go out there and say, I'm going to learn taxidermy?
I did. The genesis of this book, I was looking at a lot of really bad taxidermy on the internet just for fun.
What is bad taxidermy?
Okay, so like if someone makes taxidermy and then like the eyes are crossed or just
got
like,
it.
Like
okay.
The... And there's a lot of it. And to me, it was like specifically very funny because it looks funny, right? But it's also like something someone spent hours on and it winds up looking like completely demonic sometimes. So I was like, oh, this is very interesting to me as a person who like makes arts and crafts myself too, or grew up in this kind of place where it's like domestic arts mm-hmm. are kind of connected with taxidermy because it's a lot of sewing, it's a lot of making. So I don't know, I spent a ton of time researching in books, YouTube videos, which I keep joking around about this, but maybe it's not a joke that maybe I'm on some government watch list now. Like I was like Googling like how to dissolve flesh and I'm like, that's not normal.
No.
Yeah. But it was a lot of like research work and then a lot of chat and web forums where I wanted to see like people who actually like produce this kind of art, like where they talked with each other for like tips and tricks, how they talked specifically with each other, like the language they use, because I wanted it to sound very authentic in the mm-hmm. book when I was talking about the process and procedures. So I did. I spent a ton of time up front. And anytime in the book that there's an animal that gets taxidermied, I specifically looked up, like, what does it look like to actually be hands-on with this kind of process?
All right, let's talk about the characters mm-hmm. for a minute. And actually, I want to start with the non-human character in the book, which is Florida,
yes.
I think. You talk about, I think you said third generation, mm-hmm. Central Florida. Florida plays a central role, the character of it, as you said, sort of people's perceptions. I thought maybe you could start off by reading a passage. It's the narrator describing the ways in which her Central Florida town is changing around her.
Yeah.
Would you mind reading that for us?
Of course, sure. Newcomers renovated the beat-up sections of the downtown area, painting walls and repaving streets with brick until everyone's tires bounced at speeds over 15 miles per hour. It wasn't new to me. It was what Central Floridians did. Pave over everything so they could forget what had been there before. Theme parks and chain restaurants were built over homes and libraries. Banks took the place of family-owned businesses. There were highways built over historic areas, places where you wouldn't know something had ever happened unless a person told you or you read about it in a book. No one ever seemed to remember what came before. A kind of local amnesia, my father called it.
What did you want to convey about Florida in this book?
To me, very specifically, I wanted to put across the very physical nature of what it feels like to live in that space. Because there are these preconceived ideas about what Florida is, right? There's Florida Man or Weird Florida. There's all these things in the news that people associate with Florida. And they're true. Like, those things happen there. There is a lot of Weird Florida. Florida's very interesting. But Florida is also so much broader than that, specifically Central Florida. So in writing this book, I was very much tasking myself with making it so it was a sensory experience. Anything I wrote, I wanted it to be like, what does it look like? But okay. But also, like, what does it sound like at night when you hear the cicada kind of scree? Like, what does it smell like when you smell that kind of mildewy algae lake water, like, or a hose that's like running outside of a house that's been hot, that kind of rubbery smell? Like, what does it taste like in the air? Like, what does it feel like when, like, the air in Florida is like touching you? Because that's what it's like to live there. It's like a tactile sensation of the air almost pressing on you like hands. Mm-hmm. So I was like, if I can get across this like physical sensation of living there, then maybe I'm going to be able to get across like what I see, like the lens of my personal experience of living there.
Well, I mean, the descriptions that you just gave, it was like the studio melted away and I was sitting in this hot backyard and I could smell the hose and the mm-hmm. cicadas were making, I mean, it was very vivid. Mm-hmm. We talk to a lot of authors here who are New England authors and
right.
who talk about the ways that New England looms large in their writing. I think, you know, you're in town. Mm-hmm. How would you compare and contrast a writer's characterization of New England with what you've done with Central Florida? Florida.
Yeah, well, I think, right, like we're all working against stereotypes. I was thinking that when I even got in here, because I was trying to think, I'm like, what are stereotypes that people like write into New England, right? Like people with these heavy accents or mm-hmm. people who behave a certain way, even how traffic functions, like in Boston. I was like, these are things I've definitely like read about as these kind of tropes. And that's not necessarily how place functions, because place is so broad and people are so different. I think it's so hard to write about place because a lot of times, especially if you're from there, it's not just writing about place, it's writing about home. And writing about home is like very difficult, right? It's a love-hate relationship. And so it's maybe writing into like the things that you love about place and are trying to like uncover for people. But then also the things that like, yeah, this stereotype holds a little bit true, but let me write into it.
Or it wouldn't be a stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let me uncover it a little bit and let's talk about it a little more so we can open it up. Like, the conversation is the thing I'm interested in, I guess.
You tweet a lot.
Yes.
You're very funny on Twitter and you're very present on Twitter. You actually tweet a lot about being gay.
Mm-hmm.
Your lead character, Jessa, is gay.
Yes.
And I think many people, when they think about queer fiction, think about this kind of coming out narrative. But mm-hmm. this book is not that, which I loved about it.
Yes.
Your main character's sexuality is not treated as a moment, right? Mm-hmm. Or abnormal or the thing
yeah.
or disruptive. Was that intentional?
Very much so. Yeah, when I was saying earlier, like, oh, writing into the book, there were a couple things I knew. One of them is I wanted to write a very specific Florida. The other was I knew I did not want to write a coming out story. Coming out, too, is like, you said it yourself, it's like, it's a moment. It's this moment. It's this flash. I mean, to be fair, we often have to come out over and over again. But it's this, like, moment thing. And also, a lot of times associated with a very specific trauma of coming out. And I worry sometimes who the coming out narrative is being written for, like if it's being written for a gay audience or if it's being written for a straight audience. Mm. So it was very important to me to write in this, like, what does it look like to be like going through family issues and you happen to be gay? What does it look like to be like, oh, I have problems with intimacy and I happen to be gay? Oh, what does it look like? And I'm like kind of fighting with my brother and also my business is like failing and I have to deal with this kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. And I happen to be gay. Like, what does it look like? Just a day to day kind of lived experience. And that was the thing I wanted to write because that's the thing I want to read,
yeah.
I feel like.
In many articles and in blurbs about your book, you're described as a queer author.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to put tags and labels
yes.
As we describe authors.
Yes.
Is that a label you would use for yourself?
It's one I purposely use for myself.
So can tell more about that.
Yeah. I made a very purposeful choice several years ago to be like, as a writer who was starting to achieve some success, it felt necessary for me to put that in there. So it's like, I want to be a person who's able to kind of open the door for other people also to be able to write more queer work, mm-hmm. and putting that in your bio and putting that in your work, because it is the work I write. The work I write is very queer. So putting it in my bio and having it be very upfront in who I am as a person, I think hopefully helps other people who want to be writing that same kind of fiction have it an easier time creating and marketing and publishing that work, because it's had like maybe a small measure of success. And so it means that maybe theirs could too, because that's the work I want to read. I'm excited to read other people's queer work. So
that's great.
Yeah.
So switching gears in kind of a silly direction.
Yeah.
You love 7-Eleven.
I love 7-Eleven.
Which is kind of a cultural icon in America. You tweet a lot about it. You mm-hmm. even have a compiled memoir of tweets that is awesome that is called 7-A-Lesbian. Mm-hmm. What is it about 7-Eleven that you find so fascinating?
It really, to me, it has like a very home feeling. I mean, my specific 7-Eleven, I spend a lot of time there. Like right when I go out of town, I tell them. Like when I got my book tour schedule, I gave it to them. I wanted them to know I wasn't dead. Yeah. I didn't come in. I'm there all the time. Because it's a place where it's like, I've spent like so many holidays. It's like my neighborhood place. I kind of call it my neighborhood bar. It's like my Cheers, I guess.
Awesome.
I mean, I know the people that work there. I get a lot of my food there.
All right, so what's your favorite consumption from 7-Eleven?
First of all, I keep like Steel Reserve in business there, which is like technically malt liquor, but it's such a value. And also I buy like, you know, some nights it's a roller hot dog night, but other nights, you know, maybe I want combos or a chip, and they have a wide variety of chips there. So I feel like there's been so many times, too, where I buy food and I just hang out in there.
Yeah.
I like to spend time there.
And have you been to a 7-Eleven in Boston yet? Is 7-Eleven universally the same or different?
Well, I think there is like a similarity to a lot of 7-Elevens, which makes it so comforting to me. Like there's this smell that's in all these like specific 7-Elevens. The lighting is all very similar. Many of the products are the same. You're just getting like a lot of the same, which is great. It's like mm-hmm. a very comfortable thing, especially if you're in a place where you're stressed or you don't know where you are or like have some kind of like anxiety. It's nice to be able to go in a place and feel like this kind of calming, like, oh, a little piece of home happening right here. I have not been to one here yet, but anytime I see a 7-Eleven, I go into one. So if I pass one here, I'm obviously going into one in Boston.
There are many to choose from.
Yeah.
All right. Before you go, you're very active on Twitter, as we said.
Yes.
Most people just aren't funny, let alone funny on Twitter, let alone funny most of the time mm-hmm. on Twitter. So one, do you set out to be funny? Mm. And two, do you think about how you write on Twitter the same or differently than how you would write something like Mostly Dead Things?
Yeah, I think because I write a lot of different kind of ways and different types of work. Sometimes I think about Twitter as like attempting stand-up.
Interesting.
Because it is a thing, too, where I'm like, I'm trying out jokes sometimes mm-hmm. and see how they go over. I'll like do like a themed joke. There's this like terrible joke I do all the time about ravioli. The thing for me is like, if I get humor out of it, then I'll keep doing it. And once it starts to be not interesting to me, then I'm like, okay, let me try something else out. So it's a kind of writing, right? It almost feels like it's stand-up, but it feels like practice, mm-hmm. like feels like practicing and like work in like very small contained little segments of text, which, and I love language and I love thinking about like how you can make things punchier, like how you can twist a sentence and make it super dumb, because I think things that are absurd are very funny. So I think I am funny, which maybe helps. Like I think that things that are stupid are funny, and I think I'm supremely dumb a lot of the time on the internet. So I don't know. It's that for me is like a fun time. Like if I didn't have a good time doing it, I just wouldn't.
All right. So I have to ask you then, I wasn't planning on asking this.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever try stand-up?
Oh my gosh. That seems so hard, and absolutely not.
Okay.
I'm just going to do Twitter stand-up.
Okay, there we go. That's Kristen Arnett. Her new novel is Mostly Dead Things. Kristen, thanks so much for being with us here on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.